Fake News and False History. The 1913 Leo Frank Case in the Midst of a 21st Century Jewish-Gentile Culture War by Moses Jacobs, the rape murder victim, Mary Ann Fagan, 1-899-1913. Attention hash, Me Too activists. We are calling on all feminists and folks advocating against the stigmatization of sexual assault survivors. We are calling upon you to use your voice for children's rights to peacefully confront by open letters. Israel Zionist advocacy groups like ADL and other Jewish organizations, including their individual associates, who promote the misogynist, bigoted, prejudiced, racist, and anti-Gentile Leo Frank hoax that he was innocent and a martyr of anti-Semitism. The century of bullying with this case has become enough is enough. The time to push back is now. Breaking news, February 2019 during Black History Month, Amazon Books, in ironically racist contradiction to Jeff Bezos' claim, Democracy Dies in Darkness, has removed from its website the Nation of Islam's book series, Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volumes 1, 2, and 3. Volume 3 was a scholarly monograph on the Leo Frank case and its aftermath. Allegations of Jewish advocacy groups partnering with big tech companies to lead censorship efforts abound on the internet. It's no longer a secret that the ADL and SPLC are working with tech titans to censor the internet and make it safe for Zionist bullies. The anti-Semitism smear. The American Mercury, described as a deeply anti-Semitic website by Abraham Foxman and the Anti-Defamation League, has produced an authorized 29-part audiobook serial of Noe's highly contested Volume 3 in the year 2018, which is astoundingly well done. Extraordinarily prolific neo-Nazi demagogue Alex Linder, who has personally produced more than 10,000 pages of audiobooks on classical anti-Semitic books at his VNN forum discussion groups, Learning College, published in 2017 an unauthorized version of Noe's Volume 3 with anti-Black racist commentary. Jewish groups are likely misusing this independent creation to conflate any attempt to expose the fake history surrounding the Leo Frank case with anti-Semitism. The modern Leo Frank case revival backstory requires traveling in time to December 1998. Jason Robert Brown and Alfred Uri reignites the centenary Jewish-Gentile-Southern conflict, smoldering like a California wildfire in the streets of Manhattan, New York City. After 84 shows, the musical closed. On Broadway, where the money is made with multiple showings a day, that's considered a flop. However, a second release of the musical would change all that at a later time. Before the turn of the millennia, Y2K, just a little more than a baker's dozen years before the double centennial of Mary Fagan's rape strangulation, April 26, 1913, April 26, 2013, and Leo Frank's lynching, August 17, 1915, August 17, 2015, there was what already appeared to be the nascent great revival of interest in this nearly forgotten, infamous criminal affair, one almost lost in the annals of Atlanta, Georgia's legal history. Two kingly drama queens brought it back to life. Together, Jason Robert Brown and Alfred Uri were a dynamic duo. They were helped significantly by Harold Prince, deceased. It was the December 1998 launch of the Leo Frank Broadway musical, Parade, that forever changed the course of historical interest of the nearly forgotten Frank Fagan affair, lighting one lengthy fuse attached to a crate full of Jewish-Gentile relations dynamite. Prior to 1998, there seemed almost little interest in this contentious case, except in the Jewish community, which was sometimes reticent about the subject. It was almost forgotten as a curious kind of artifact from the early 20th century history of the American South. Yet even today, most people aren't aware Leo Frank's 1913 case would be mentioned in important Supreme Court legal decisions in the decades hence when involving issues with respect to habeas corpus. 1988, one decade prior, January 24, 26, 1988, there was a two-part made-for-TV miniseries, The Murder of Mary Fagan, which outraged many Southerns for its defamation of Gentiles and false history portrayal of the true crime events. The film continues to anger people who study the Frank Fagan true crime because of Hollywood's dishonest portrayals of the principals in the case. The Board of Pardons and Paroles, Atlanta, Georgia. 2 years prior to this four-hour NBC television special, a trinity of Jewish activist groups, Anti-Defamation League of B&I Brith, Atlanta Jewish Federation, and American Jewish Committee had secured an illegal posthumous pardon of Leo Frank some 73 years after the Fagan molestation slaying. Oddly enough, the 1986 Frank pardon did not officially exculpate the perverted sex killer for the capital crime for which he was duly convicted. There was a lot of moaning and groaning in the muttering that followed from the dubious political pardon. How peculiar, people whispered rhetorically of the outcome. In 1986, Leo Frank was pardoned a full lifetime after his unnatural death, but the issue of his innocence or guilt was intentionally avoided. Thus, he was never officially absolved, and therefore his conviction remains unmodified and was never set aside. By pardoning Leo Frank, he had to be collectively acknowledged as guilty by the tribunal. But when the board refused to make an official declaration of his innocence, Jewish groups worked thereafter to put in place a Marietta cemetery, historical marker, scrub the sentence that Leo Frank was still officially guilty. The information to be erased from the public eye was, his 1986 pardon is based on the state's failure to protect him, apprehend his killers, not his innocence. In the 1980s, many senior citizen members of the Jewish community at large, who were alive as children during 1913, were embarrassed by the cringe-worthy finale of the four-year pardon ordeal, 1982-1986, feeling a sense of tired defeat and humiliation for the old ghosts, which had been dug up from their quiet graves for yet another anticlimactical curtain drop. Most Gentile Georgians were outraged, but reticent to speak out publicly. However, one of the most respected jurists in Georgia at the time spoke out about the unconstitutionality of the bogus pardon. Court of Appeals biography of Justice Randall Evans. Randall Evans Jr. was born May 3, 1906, in Thompson, Georgia, into a large, poor, but hardworking family. He attended McDuffie County Schools and there attained good marks and the position of captain on the track team. After graduation, he could not afford to go to college. Instead, he started the study of law at Maynard Law School in Macon, Georgia, under the tutelage of Liege Maynard. He earned his LLB degree after 70 days as Maynard's apprentice, graduating in 1924. Thereafter, Randall Evans, Jr., passed the bar exam at age 18. He practiced as an associate under Lige Maynard in 1925. After a year of practice with Maynard, Evans decided that he would rather return to his hometown of Thompson, Georgia, and did so in 1926. There, he started a law practice with his brother Jack Evans, which joint practice lasted roughly a year. In 1927, Randall Evans, Jr. started his individual law practice in Thompson, Georgia. His practice consisted of general practice, which gradually grew into a well-renowned personal injury tort litigation practice. In 1929, at age 23, he became the youngest elected state representative to ever sit in the Georgia General Assembly. While serving in the legislature, he served simultaneously as city attorney for Thompson and county attorney for McDuffie County. On Christmas Day, 1930, he married the love of his life, the beautiful Tulline Moy of Wrightsville, Georgia. His reputation spread from near to far as a steadfast defender of the little man, the underdog, who was injured, hurt, and helpless, and one who worked tirelessly to vindicate his client's rights. His time was divided between public service and private practice for his clients. Not only did he serve in both the Georgia State Senate and the House of Representatives, he also became the youngest speaker of the House of Representatives when the honor came to him at age 35. He even ran for governor of the state of Georgia before returning to his beloved clients back home. He was at home in a courthouse, having tried cases in almost every county in this fine state. When in time of trial, Randall Evans, Jr. considered it a battle to the death for his client. He believed totally in his client's causes, and he gave unselfishly of himself in representing them. His deep feelings and emotional involvement in a case were passed through to the jury when arguing to them by his great fervor and zest in presenting his case. And usually, justice was on the side of Randall Evans, Jr., as the juries returned verdicts in his client's favor. He would return home to his great and faithful lifelong companion, Tallene, and he would smile into her beautiful face and say, "You can't win them all, but we won this one." His 57-year legal career was marked for a change in 1969. It was then that Governor Lester Maddox approached Evans with an offer to appoint him to the Georgia Court of Appeals. Randall Evans, Jr., exhibiting frank sincerity and brashness, quickly informed Governor Maddox that he did not vote for him. That did not mean anything to Governor Maddox, who only sought to appoint a man of high wisdom to the jurists then sitting on the Court of Appeals. Thus, Evans ascended the bench. He served in that capacity with fairness and a continuous legal analytical approach that will always benefit those who study his opinions. In 1975, he was bestowed a unique honor by being awarded Most Outstanding Appellate Judge in the Nation by the Association of Trial Lawyers at their meeting in Ontario, Canada. A year later, Judge Randall Evans, Jr. stepped down from the bench into a well-deserved retirement. He left the Capitol for his home of Thompson, Georgia. Evans soon found that his retirement was to be short-lived, for lawyers throughout the state of Georgia were constantly calling him, seeking his learned and sage advice. He constantly counseled attorneys who were in the midst of trial as to how to pursue strategies that would best help their clients' cases get to the jury. A young lawyer once told Randall Evans, Jr., of a remark the young lawyer made to the opposing counsel when on trial. That is, the young lawyer looking across the way at the three opposing counsel, who were older, more experienced, and very sure of their case, told them, "I have something that you do not have. I have a secret weapon." The other older lawyers looked at him curiously and asked, "What is it that you have? What is your secret weapon?" The young lawyer replied, slowly, quietly, but yet very proudly, "I have Randall Evans, Jr.'s phone number in my pocket." On November 30, 1986, Randall Evans, Jr. passed away. With his passing, Georgia lost one of the finest men of this state. He was an orator, author, statesman, scholar, lawyer, judge, advocate, and a friend. However, Georgia's loss was heaven's gain. 182 Georgia Appeals Reports, pages Alkson LX citation, Court of Appeals of Georgia, https://www.gappeals.us/history/judge-sphp. I'd equal sign 42 former Georgia Supreme Court Justice Randall Evans Jr. wrote about the illegality of the largely symbolic fake pardon, but no one contested the declarative issue, allowing it to stand as a paper tiger or figurative participation award. The pardon of Leo Frank opened new wounds because it was clearly not justified. Criminals are unfortunately murdered all the time at the hands of others when serving their sentences. Even if one example was an uncommon occurrence, it doesn't retroactively take away their convictions. In truth, the Frank Fagan case was no artifact from a forgotten part of early 20th century jurisprudence, even if today, most people have never heard of this true crime saga. The appeals in this case to the U.S. Supreme Court had later shaped and elucidated legalistic interpretations of habeas corpus decades after the fact. Little did anyone know at the time, so far and long ago, there was a smoldering political inferno set alight after the discovery of a dead little girl in the earliest morning hours of Sunday, April 27, 1913. Fagan's corpse was found mauled, mutilated, disfigured, and discarded in the rear corner of the National Pencil Company's basement, some 15 hours after she had been theorized killed at noontime on Saturday, the 26th day of April, in a room located opposite Leo Frank's accounting office. And though Fagan's cadaver was initially found dumped in the factory's cellar, it would take the police one day to figure out the real scene of the crime was two floors above in the factory's machine room, known colloquially as the metal room. The metal room was where Mary Fagan had worked for 53 weeks straight until she was sexually abused and snuffed out by the factory superintendent. When police began interviewing her co-workers, salacious stories emerged about Leo Frank's lewd behavior toward his child laborers. He was also seen taking a forelady, Rebecca Carson, into the women's dressing room for 15 to 20-minute trysts 3 times a week. Leo Frank's 5-year-long occupied office was located opposite the machining area where Fagan worked, see second floor plats in BOE of the National Pencil Company, and he was the last known person to openly admit having seen her alive before she was theorized to have been killed shortly thereafter. Studies have shown that typically the last person to have been affirmatively identified as seeing a slain victim is a majority of the time is the perpetrator. A peculiar detail was that Mary Fagan's machine desk was right near to the hallway door of the men's toilet, and Leo Frank had to pass next to her assembling pencils each day when he had to use the bathroom. Frank denied knowing Mary Fagan, even though he used the toilet every workday, and employees testified that he was always bothering her about non-work-related stuff. Some employees clearly remember him placing his hands on her shoulders and calling her Mary. Many reasoned, how could he have forgotten her name when he was inappropriately touching her at work? Within the metal room was a large area called the tipping department. This is where Fagan worked, using a knurling machine, inserting rubber erasers into the brass cylinders of pencil caps. Mary Fagan's workstation was right by the entryway to the men's toilet, something which must be repeated because Leo Frank's defenders have tried to suppress this fact. Putting incredulity into Leo Frank's repeated statements, he did not know this employee, that he had to walk next to a matter of a couple of feet for reaching the water closet. Leo Frank, a well-known copious drinker of black coffee, a fact backed up by his wife in press interviews, would have likely needed to urinate at least once or twice per 11-hour workday. So oddly, Leo Frank would use the need to relieve his bowels and bladder as an explanation at the trial of why his office was found empty by Montine Stover, an event signifying a possible solution to the whodunit murder mystery. It was the wow moment at the climax of trial on the afternoon of August 18th when Leo Frank made this statement of his whereabouts on that fateful day, sustaining the prosecution's chain of events. Pre-dawn, Sunday, April 27th, 1913. The factory director, Mr. Leo M. Frank, had been called at 3:50 o'clock a.m. on the wall phone in his business office by police, but he never answered it until about 7 a.m., and he was not suspected of the crime until days later, as Atlanta PD began building profiles, collecting evidence, interrogating people of interest, and gathering depositions. The case of Mary Fagan becomes Leo Frank's criminal affair. Without a definitive prime suspect at first, other than the weakly suspected night watchman, Newt Lee, the case of Mary Fagan quickly metamorphosized days later into the case of Leo Frank when he was arrested on suspicion of murder, Tuesday, April 29th. Just before the noon hour of this day, Frank forever lost his freedom. He was arrested at 11:30 a.m. and held in a private holding cell at the station house. The Patsy Gets the Gunfire Spotlight. Leo Frank had made a number of incriminating statements that began to turn the tide of evidence against him. On Sunday, April 27th, he at first told police the Negro night watchman's time card was punched correctly every half hour, as it was expected to be on the day the murder had taken place. But on Monday, April 28th, he told police there was 4 hours worth of punches missing that he had overlooked. Frank lied and said his foreman, N.V. Darley, had pointed the discrepancy out. It was such a reckless blunder on Leo Frank's part because the cops standing next to Leo Frank on Sunday morning, April 27th, eyeballed the time card with him, and Newt Lee was standing right there, handcuffed, looking onward. The cops didn't memorize the exact minutes on each 30-minute punch or take the card to the station house as evidence. They just let Leo Frank keep the card and put it in his safe. But what they did remember was seeing that approximately every half the card had an appropriate timestamp corresponding to the numbering system at the left side of the sheet. The 2009 ADL-approved propagandistic documentary People vs. Leo Frank by Jewish-American film director Ben Loderman and Steve Oney briefly touches upon this contentious issue. In a rare moment of honesty, at approximately 13 minutes and 30 seconds, going forward, the drama film barely glosses over the Newt Lee time card debacle. Now pay special attention to Newt Lee's time card and how the timestamp increases every half hour starting from punch 101 at the left. Between punch 108 and 109, it's missing a 10 p.m. timestamp. Between punch 110 and 111, it's missing an 11:30 p.m. timestamp. Between punch 111 and 112 is missing the 12:30 a.m. timestamp. Punch 114 to 115 is missing a 2:30 p.m. timestamp. The highest probability is that Frank forged the newfangled incriminating time card. In the skeptical minds of Atlanta police, it began to look a lot like Leo Frank was trying to pin the crime on the old black graveyard shift security guard, Newt Lee. They asked, how did four punches go missing on his timesheet? Leo Frank bungled his racist intrigue, big time blundered. On Sunday, April 27, 1913, with Newt Lee present and the police holding him in handcuffs, they went to Leo Frank's office. Frank pulled the April 27, 1913 timesheet belonging to Newt Lee, saying it was punched every half hour plus slash, a few minutes. The police eyeballed the timesheet with him and noted it was correct. Why, with two police officers witnessing the 30-minute stamps, would Leo Frank do something so reckless on Monday, April 28, 1913, giving the police a newly created time card missing four obvious 30-minute stamps? What would make the brainy Leo M. Frank even conceive of doing something so incriminatingly outlandish? Strange last words. What was even more telling were two mysterious notes written in black dialect, suggesting a tall, slim night watch, misspelled as night witch, had committed a sexual assault upon Mary Fagan. These notes, dubbed the death notes or murder notes, described the physical appearance of Newt Lee. If this line of forged evidence had played out as Leo Frank intended, Newt Lee would have been a dead man in the making. He would have most certainly been hanged. But the police felt something wasn't connecting, because Newt Lee had no criminal record, was married, had come to work 6 hours after the rape murder was theorized to have taken place, and typically old Negroes who were in their early 60s were seldom deadly rapists. Newt Lee just didn't fit the profile of a pathological killer rapist. The police brutalized Newt Lee using the old-fashioned 3RD degree method. They fired a gun at point-blank range next to his head. His ears rang numb and he collapsed, crumbling to the floor into tears. Then a contiguous series of different interrogation games began, good cops and bad cops visiting him in turns, some bearing gifts, others presenting new tortures such as sleep deprivation and making him sleep on ice-cold, hard floors. The police put the screws to Newt Lee until he was psychologically shattered, but he stuck to the main thrust of his story. Finally, the cops beat him with a wet rubber hose so there would be no obvious bruises on his body. It was a miracle the old Negro survived the brutality. Hash Black Lives Matter depositions accumulated. It wasn't long before child laborers at the NPCO, National Pencil Company, Inc., were coming forward to report Leo Frank was propositioning them for sex on their payday. Saturdays at noon was the standard day and time for employees to receive their paychecks. Frank would use the brief moment just before giving his child employees their wages to test them, to rake them, to see if they might be compliant to his bisexual sexual needs or potentially might be open to the idea in the future. Leo Frank was grooming the boys and girls who worked for him. Conley's breakdown. A month later, police would find out through third-degree interrogation methods that the peculiar death notes were written not by Mary Fagan, but by a black man, James Jim Conley, allegedly at Leo Frank's orders, with the intention of pinning Fagan's death on the patsy, Newt Lee. Leo Frank's racist intrigue was designed to play on the violent rage white men felt when Negroes raped their women or had down-low consensual relationships with them. The idea that an old Negro had raped a white little girl would have almost surely meant a mob would have stormed to the jailhouse, overpowering the security guards and lynching Newt Lee. It would have been a case closed, and Leo Frank would have gotten away with it all scot-free. An innocent man would have died, and a guilty man would have gone on with his life, but probably would have committed similar crimes in the future with more caution. Leo Frank's racist plot collapsed due to a number of silly mistakes he made, one of which was thinking Jim Conley would keep his mouth shut on the promise of $200, 6 months' wages. Atlanta newspaper frenzy. Once Atlanta's highly competitive local daily press organs, Atlanta Constitution, Atlanta Georgian, and Atlanta Journal, got a firm hold of the controversy in the days, weeks, months, and years that followed, screaming headlines from day one, eventually caused the scandal to go viral in Georgia, initially, and in the South, shortly thereafter. With the help of Jewish Americans, Adolf Uchs, owner of NY Times, and Albert Lasker, described as a marketing wizard by Leonard Dinnerstein, the case went viral nationally in 1913, 1914, and 1915, having metastasized into the biggest Jewish American cause célèbre of its time, and arguably one of the top-tier historical events in American Jewish social history. Albert Davis Lasker, May 1, 1880, May 30, 1952. Modern interest growing. At present, the century-old story refuses to stop being retold, often with greater fervor in the media every single year, peaking in coverage on the 17th of August, the Frank lynching anniversary. Even the date of the Fagan murder is getting more coverage every forthcoming decade. Without fail, post-centenary, the Frank Fagan case continues to garner major mainstream media headline coverage every late April and mid-August. Some notable examples are The Washington Post, Business Insider, and Salon Magazine. Before 2015, the true crime was only given lesser page six coverage, and sometimes in even prior years, it was hardly even mentioned, that is, until Broadway reignited the affair in the consciousness of the masses. Not many people had heard of the sensational criminal epic before the musical. Parade became wildly popular in its second iteration, post-millennium. The first iteration of Parade flopped after 84 showings. Its second iteration went viral internationally in theaters, literally everywhere. Recap: 2017 anniversary treatments of the Frank Fagan case. For this year's 2017 Fagan murder anniversary, some treatments were released approximately mid to late April. Most notably, the case of Mary Fagan was featured in two apparently biased stories, one by a self-described Jewish activist who behaves like a false history professor, Ingrid Anderson, in a Salon magazine repost, and one by fake news journalist Jacob Bogage in Washington Post. Both articles mangle the facts of the case. In the Salon magazine story, Anderson claimed Leo Frank was actually exonerated of the Fagan sex killing, when in fact his posthumous pardon 7 decades after the fact did not officially absolve him of the murder. According to the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, the tribunal who rendered their March 11, 1986, posthumous pardon of Leo Frank, they emphatically stated that they were not addressing the issue of his guilt or innocence. Yet, they had to unofficially agree to his guilt in order to give him a fake pardon. Oh, the irony. Leo Frank's guilty verdict has never been overturned to date, 2019. Even now, 106 years later, there are Frankite activists like Rabbi Stephen LeBeau, Roy Barnes, and Dale Schwartz working behind the scenes with garden variety Jewish activists groups, trying to get the government of Georgia to officially recognize Leo Frank as innocent. But to do this, they must get his guilty verdict set aside. They are still hunting for a kangaroo activist judge who will disgrace himself or herself to do it. Though Leo Frank is still officially guilty as charged, this fact hasn't stopped people from trying to rewrite history and claim he was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted whenever his 1913 summer trial is mentioned. The ADL is at the forefront of this propaganda campaign because this biased activist organization was founded on his behalf. A great effort led by the Jewish community has been made over the decades to create a mainstream popular cultural mythology that Leo Frank was railroaded because of anti-Semitism, not the facts tried in a courthouse, and thus his August 25, 1913 conviction, his devotee's claim was patently unjust and rendered by mob terrorism. However, when pressed, most of his defenders struggle to or cannot give any specific anti-Jewish examples that supposedly led to his guilty verdict, except citing the tired anti-Gentile canards mainstreamed by Leonard Dinnerstein, the Samuelas, and Harry Golden, that wild hordes of Christian men thronging outside the courtroom were screaming anti-Semitic death threats into the open windows of the courthouse directly at the judge and jury. That racist hoax is fake news. The mythos surrounding Leo Frank's supposed innocence seems to be based around anti-Gentile tropes about supposed widespread anti-Semitism and societal tensions. The agrarian economy becoming one of industrialization caused his conviction, according to the pro-Frank activist narrative, that simply did not exist or play a part in Frank's trial, respectively, in the overwhelmingly philo-Semitic American South of 1913. Even Jewish historians have a difficult time finding examples of Southern anti-Semitism in the 19th and 20th centuries. The historical consensus is the South was philo-Semitic at the time, so the accusations of anti-Semitism are a racist and anti-Gentile hate crime hoax. The silent minority of Jews. The general consensus within minority circles of Jewish historians is the Old South, also the overlapping period of the antebellum South and Progressive Era, were well known historically to be tolerant toward Jews, given the very high prevalence of intermarriage and successful Jewish-Gentile business partnerships. The South was a place where the Jewish community thrived in business and society. During the Civil War of the early to mid-1860s, Judah P. Benjamin's face was at one time printed on Confederate money, and Jews disproportionately owned slaves and had African-American household staff, according to census records. The temple bombing hate crime hoax? When Jewish historians are pressed, the 1958 temple bombing is mentioned as one of the most egregious acts of anti-Semitism in Georgia. But no one was ever convicted of the crime, and one man who was falsely accused, George Bright, had been acquitted at trial. Reading the contrived Wikipedia article on the temple bombing, you would think it impossible Bright was innocent. However, Jewish American scholar Melissa Faye Green, who wrote an account of the incident in 1996 and is considered the foremost expert on the subject, believes Bright was innocent. At the time of the 1958 temple bombing, fake news, New York Times, had, just like it did with the 1913 Leo Frank case, misrepresented the facts and evidence of the bombing egregiously. When you read the fabricated Wikipedia article on the temple bombing, it is written with trickery and advanced sophistry by activist editors who almost exclusively use the NY Times in its bibliography. The Wikipedia article on the temple bombing does not comport with the Bright trial legal records, in the exact same way the Wikipedia article on Leo Frank does not comport with the Frank case legal records. We are living in an ongoing age of disinformation by the fake news media. Moreover, the damage done to a 12-foot by 12-foot wall in the adjacent room of the temple was repaired with money raised by primarily Christian Gentiles and voluntary Baptist denomination bricklayers. Donations from almost exclusively Christians and state grants exceeded $832,302. Source: Atlanta Temple Officially Closes Campaign by Alfred Rosenberg for repairs, which ended up costing in the low double-digit thousands. It turned out to be a windfall for the synagogue and sent a clear message that such attacks could be used to raise obscene amounts of money. Given how many hate crime hoaxes against religious institutions have been uncovered in the last few decades, the temple bombing might easily have actually been an early example of a mid-century hate crime hoax. The explosion was at a location where no one was hurt and no valuable assets were damaged on the inside. Other than a brick wall facade and the hard foam ceiling tiles, the room had not been a high-value target area containing anything of significant importance. Nothing priceless was lost. Everything was easily replaced. According to the temple website, the explosion caused almost $100,000 worth of damage, approximately $750,000 today. Actually, the materials were only in the double-digit thousands of dollars, not $100,000, and some of those Christian men who did the actual physical labor repairing the site and bricklaying did so on a voluntary basis. That means they worked for free. After much hoopla, more than $800,000 was left over from donations when the smoke cleared and the masonry work was completed. None of the claims about retaliation against the synagogue could ever be substantiated. Even Wikipedia isn't safe from grievance activist hoaxers. Profiling terroristic attacks against religious institutions, a significant percentage of seemingly hate crime incidences almost invariably turn out to be hoaxes when people are not specifically targeted violently in the attacks. There are websites that document chronologically hate crime hoaxes, biggest Jewish hate crime hoax in American history. During 2016 and 2017, in 2016 and 2017, there were more than 120 hate crimes against Jewish institutions purportedly orchestrated by neo-Nazi terrorists, which turned out to be the hoaxery dirty work of a 19-year-old Israeli citizen and Zionist activist. The ADL did not remove these fake crimes from its statistics analysis, meant to show the growing hate epidemic of white extremists, and they continue to raise donations of 7 to 8 figures, while censoring the crimes against the Palestinian people. Another series of hate crime hoaxes by purportedly white extremists turned out to be the work of a black man seeking revenge because he was spurned by his white girlfriend. The media swept the incident under the rug. In another incident, a Jewish girl was caught on camera drawing a swastika on her own dorm room door to garner sympathy. She got off with a slap on the wrist and transferred to another university. One of the more notorious hate crime hoaxes going back into the 1980s was involving Al Sharpton, after the fact, and Tawana Brawley, who covered herself in human feces as an attempted victim bamboozle. The media went wild with the story, and after it was discovered as a hoax, it was swept under the rug. Jacob Bogage's False News and Fake History. Jacob Bogage's Washington Post article makes the false claim that Leo Frank's accessory after the fact, Jim Conley, spent his life in and out of jail for convictions of violence against women. Categorically false, we have a copy of his criminal record. Conley was once fined for having a very loud and emotional argument with his common-law wife, but served no time. His rap sheet is mostly about public intoxication, and at one time he tried breaking into a Negro-owned pharmacy in 1919, as it was reported in the press at the time. When he pried open the pharmacy's front door after jimmying the lock, he was shot in the chest, wounded severely, and miraculously survived. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison and released after 15 years on good behavior. The only other major sentence of jail time Conley earned for himself was for his role as an accessory after the fact in helping Leo Frank cover up the murder of Mary Fagan in the immediate aftermath of the factory sweatshop boss raping and strangling her. Conley helped the police solve the case after breaking down under 3 weeks of interrogation. Leo Frank enlisted Conley to remove the dead body from Frank's office floor to the basement 2 floors below. Conley only served 10 months' time as an accessory after the fact for helping to attempt to cover up Leo Frank's sex murder. Conley's confession of his role in the removal of the dead child helped the police put the pieces of the puzzle together with better clarity. Leo Frank, when given the opportunity, refused to confront Jim Conley, even with his lawyers present. There are too many other errors to mention in Bogage's and Anderson's articles, but you can read about them in other fact-checking reports published online. A number of articles go into meticulous detail debunking them both. Leo Frank's defenders engage in all sorts of bamboozling behavior and have not stopped doing so since 1913. In response to the 2 false history and fake news articles published respectively in Salon and Washington Post in April 2017, a white activist website National Vanguard published a radio program, Leo Frank Making a Martyr Hour of a Murderer, promoting a new book published the year before on April 26, 2016, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3, Leo Frank Guilty Man Lynched by NOI Research Group, with NOI standing for Nation of Islam. Both white and Jewish extremists seem to be fighting over the facts of this case. What a truly sad world we live in that we have to go to controversial websites to learn the truth about the Leo Frank case. It's like the world is turned upside down. NOI is an unabashedly pro-black, anti-white, and anti-Jewish organization. Their book makes the case Leo Frank is guilty, basically. It's an opposing mirror image of all the Leo Frank partisan books written with the intention of perpetuating the self-serving narrative of the Jewish community that Leo Frank was framed because of anti-Semitism. The NOI compilation is probably the most well-researched book on the Leo Frank case published to date. There is even a free, no sign-up required, audiobook of it published by the American Mercury. In the NOI compilation proposes the thesis that Leo Frank was not only guilty, but that he attempted a racially tinged and anti-Gentile framing against two of his African-American employees, first Newt Lee, followed by the accomplice after the fact, James Jim Conley. Despite the obviously biased language of this particular Leo Frank detractor-oriented book and some snarky or snide comments within it, surprisingly, it makes a very well-reasoned set of arguments propounding that Leo Frank failed miserably in his racist attempt to frame the murder of Mary Fagan on Newt Lee, his Negro night watchman, and Jim Conley, the Negro custodian at the factory. This is one of the biggest secrets of the case that has brought it to the attention of Black Lives Matter activists and the Me Too movement. Frank embarrassed himself in the process, and the greater Jewish community made in part of anti-Gentile groups, which racketeer anti-Semitism and fear-mongering, have taken up Leo Frank's status as a civil rights icon and martyr with dogmatic and religious zealousness. It's time Jews and Gentiles have conferences to discuss the affair without all the ad hominem attacks like calling people Hitler if they believe Leo Frank was a misogynist, racist, habitual pedophile, rapist, and sex killer. The New York Times, once owned by Jewish press magnate Adolf Oakes. It is becoming well known that Adolf Oakes took on the case of Leo Frank between 1913-1915 as his own cynical personal crusade. This year's mid-August 2017 lynching anniversary, the Frank case was featured or mentioned with prominence in the fake news New York Times, the left-biased Time magazine, and on the anti-Gentile Jewish Israel activist Anti-Defamation League's website. Raising eyebrows, ADL's treatments insensitively attempted to conflate the Leo Frank case outcome with the recent nighttime torch-lit Unite the Right rally and the ensuing next-day car-ramming tragedy in Charlottesville at the end of a rally. Activists have repeatedly asked the ADL to stop using tragedies to conflate them with the Leo Frank case, using sensitive events to rehabilitate Leo Frank as an example of their callousness. The ADL has in the past tried disgustingly to compare the Leo Frank case to the Shoah. In another event, many leftist activists and feminists were livid when ADL tried to equate the child-molesting homicidal pervert, Leo Frank, with Heather Heyer, who was not directly hit by the vehicular ramming but died of a heart attack during the aftermath of James Field's vehicle plowing through the protest. Update September 2021. Asterisk. At a public school in Cobb County, September 2021, a student troll drew a crudely designed swastika over a urinal that students frequented when nature called. He got what he wanted in that he wanted to create huge throngs of outcry, and that he did. Nobody was amused but the perp, and perhaps other shitlord types might have got a giggle about it, but parents from white students protested that it was completely unacceptable the student got a slap on the wrist. Christians came out in droves to protest against the behavior, and some Jewish residents showed up as well and dragged Leo Frank into the fray. Many righteous Gentiles community members were happy to come out in droves to denounce the swastikas, but the attempt to use Leo Frank as some kind of civil rights icon for fighting racism was just pure plain gouch. Everyone had their smartphone cameras out in this public space and were taking photos. It was heartwarming and restored my faith in humanity to see that Christians had come out in force to denounce the swastikas. August 17th, every year. It seems the Leo Frank lynching anniversary is being used as a kind of proto-fundraising tool for ADL, and also furthering attempts at rehabilitating him more widely in the American mainstream media and among Jews worldwide. It gives the impression that fear-mongering with narratives of anti-Semitism and conflation of his case with unrelated tragedies, like Heather Heyer or the Shoah, for instance, is decidedly a lucrative racket for ADL. There is no comparison with the misogynist and racist Leo Frank and Charlottesville protests against white supremacy when one delves into the dark depths of these mutually exclusive events. Leftist activists are beginning to see Ashkenazi defense groups as simply white supremacist groups fighting against Gentile white supremacists groups. Jews are no longer seen as victims in the eyes of the left due to Israel's 72-year history of crimes against humanity and colonial invasion of the region. The American Mercury strikes back with vervy wit. In response to the three false history and fake news articles published in the left-leaning major mainstream media, MSM outlets, the contentious American Mercury put out a professional audiobook series about the Leo Frank trial, surprisingly a well-balanced treatment. After listening to the first half of the series, I can see why Jewish-Israeli activists groups like ADL would seek to discredit the people who supposedly produce the online magazine, because the arguments presented there are soundly convincing that Leo Frank is guilty and that his conviction was not based on any anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, but ultimately, fair-minded justice. Leo Frank's trial was fair based on reports of it in the press at the time and the records of his appeal from A to Z. This is the case, even though some judges commenting on the case had been influenced by the popular propaganda news sources of the time. Can you guess the high jurist's name? The Leo Frank revival at Vivian Beaumont Theater. Talk of the case that dares not speak its name was mostly quiescent until December 1998, when Jason Robert Brown and Alfred Uri launched the Leo Frank Broadway musical called Parade, named after the Confederate Memorial Parade. It was a mix of chorus singing, Confederate flag waving, replicated vintage clothes from the late 19th century and early 20th century, dancing, singing, marching, cakewalking, parading around on stage, theatrical acting, drama, and telling the story of a Southern Jewess who was married to a Yankee Jew who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So Frank's life goes sideways, and he somehow got mixed up in a criminal entanglement involving an underage Christian girl, allegedly. Through the chaos and controversy, the cold, emotionally distant Leo Frank finally falls in love with his wife again, Lucille Seelig, before his life ends at the end of a rope lynched by a Gentile mob of bigoted yahoos. This play is clearly meant to express a sanitized version of anti-Gentile melodrama behind a historical face mask of a hyper-partisan narrative where Leo Frank's innocence is taken for granted as gospel. As to be expected, the theatrical version of Leo Frank's tumultuous life during the years before he was extrajudicially killed are deeply imbued with creative license that seems to almost invert reality when one actually takes closer looks at the records of his life and primary sources of his infamous legal travails. Not to mention, the aftermath of his life is very telling about how the case is being used to create great conflict between Jews and Gentiles. Addendum. Jewish activists are embroiled in a culture war with Gentile activists of the white to brown skin spectrum variety. Yes, even African-American groups now have a dog in this fight. Nation of Islam's infamous secret relationship series, Volume 3, The Leo Frank Case, one involving an intensification of emotionally laden ad hominem being flung around, with the most common name-calling being volleyed back and forth. Extremist, black supremacist, bigot, Jewish supremacist, white supremacist, Jewish hate mongers, Nazis, Jewish extremists, fascist globalist, Jewish fearmonger, white nationalist, Jewish nationalist, KKK, Black Panther, and Zionist pig. Whether these labels are accurate or not isn't the point at all. They are being used to discredit and dehumanize each leg in the triad of opposition. So now the great debate about the Leo Frank case becomes less about the facts, evidence, or testimony, and more about personal attacks used to end the conversation and declare victory. Moreover, these dehumanizing pejoratives literally do nothing to advance academic dialogue, fact-checking, and scholarly research, but create politically correct echo chambers, where people crystallize into their own camps of othering, which basically result in us versus them, tribe blue against tribe red, or the orange shirts against the purple shirts and vice versa. The centenary unsolved murder mystery, the sadistic sexual assault, ghastly strangulation murder and corpse mutilation of a Christian teenage girl 5 weeks short from turning 14 years old, Mary Ann Fagan, and the subsequent lynching of her convicted sex killer, Jewish industrialist and pencil manufacturing executive Leo Max Frank, has now been patently solved by legal and history scholars using the extensive 1913 official investigation and trial records. In this once-in-a-lifetime event, the book publishing houses, mainstream media, and ivory tower establishment of the Academy, who have for numerous generations since 1913 promoted the racist hoax and anti-Gentile conspiracy theory that anti-Semites framed Leo Frank for the crime simply because he was Jewish, and that the blood of a Negro was not enough to pay or atone for the crime, have been definitively proven to be wrong by the stenographed statements of Leo Frank himself. See Leo Frank Trial Statement in the Official Brief of Evidence, 1913. The Jewish Daily Forward. It was recently revealed by two Jewish American journalists in separately published articles that Abraham Kahan, founder of the Jewish Daily Forward, called Forverts at the time in 1914, interviewed Leo Frank in Atlanta, who suggested it was not anti-Semitism, but instead Keystone Cops were the primary source behind his criminal case. Leo Frank also believed that Hugh Dorsey needed to bolster his legal career as a prosecutor because he had a couple of recent embarrassing defeats in the courtroom. However, an audit of Dorsey's legal career as Solicitor General in Atlanta proves that his prime directive and motive as a prosecutor was seeking justice for victims of crimes, not about winning or losing. Kahan traveled to Atlanta in March 1914 to visit Frank in his cell in the Tower. In the fifth volume of Kahan's memoirs, published in Yiddish in 1931, Kahan relates that Frank told him the Atlanta police were desperate for a conviction. Mary Fagan's murder presented a huge challenge for prosecutor Hugh Dorsey, who had just come off the back of two embarrassing courtroom defeats. "Anti-Semitism is absolutely not the reason for this libel that has been framed against me," Leo Frank told Abraham Kahan. "It isn't the source nor the result of this sad story." Organized Jewry. Yet, even a century later, Frank's defenders in both public and private schools, synagogues, churches, civic events, history conferences, and the mainstream news medium overuse and exaggerate every sort of sectarian division as to why Frank was supposedly convicted, while distorting and suppressing the substantial evidence against him recorded in his trial brief of evidence. Leo Frank, they claim, is a martyr of anti-Semitism and has been elevated to the status of a civil rights icon used for morality tales, agitation, and fundraising by Jewish groups like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. The great breakthrough of our time is that since the legal records of the Leo Frank case have been scanned by government researchers in Atlanta and put online, the 1,800-page Leo Frank Georgia Supreme Court records is published on Flickr.com. It is now possible for people who live far away from the Georgia Legal Records and Archives office to learn why Leo Frank was really convicted, and why his defenders, who say he is innocent, have been objectively perpetuating a century of pathological lies, a web of lies involving many people past and present, where men and women with academic credentials quote and requote each other, while providing almost copycat analysis of each other, but using variant words from the thesaurus lexicon population to give the appearance of being independent researchers. In other words, Leo Frank's defenders all basically say almost exactly the same thing, however, using different colorful words, sentence structures, and syntax formulations to repeat each other's assertions in essence. These in-group self-serving tactics and strategies described above that are used for controlling the mainstream story of history are called the web of lies. And this is how politically correct academia and fake news journalism works in the United States, for controlling the narrative of false history and creating a popular culture orthodoxy that pits Jews against Gentiles and vice versa. This is why today there is a great culture war over dominating the historical jurisprudence narrative of the Leo Frank case, and as it stands today, the Jewish community remains as the majority controlling interest. This quote sums up perfectly the pro-Frank camp. When a well-packaged web of lies has been sold gradually to the masses over generations, the truth will seem utterly preposterous, and its speaker a raving lunatic. D. James Frank ineluctably entrapped himself beyond escape. At the murder trial, a stupefying admission was made by the defendant when he testified from the witness stand, amounting to what his detractors consider a pitiful cry of mercy that has the lineaments of a soft confession. Something very quietly climactic happened during the four-week People v. Leo M. Frank murder trial held within Georgia's Fulton County Superior Courthouse in the summer of 1913. Mr. Leo Max Frank inadvertently revealed the solution to the murder mystery of Mary Fagan, the epic trial of 20th century Southern legal history. The spectators sat in the tight outer arena at one of the most astounding murder trials in the history of Georgia jurisprudence. Nestled deep within the ass-breaking pews of the courtroom were the luckiest of public spectators, defense and prosecution witnesses, journalists, officials, and courtroom staff. Like gladiators inside an arena, in the center of it all, with their backs to the audience, seated in ladder-back chairs, were the most important principals. They were the state of Georgia's prosecution team, made up of three members, led by Solicitor General Hugh M. Dorsey and Frank Arthur Hooper. Arrayed against them were eight Leo Frank defense counselors, led by Luther Zeigler Rosser and Reuben Rose Arnold. The presiding judge, the Honorable Leonard Strickland Roan, sitting in a high-backed leather chair, was separated by the witness stand from the jury of 12 white men who were sworn to justly decide the fate of Leo Frank. Crouched and sandwiched between the judge's rostrum and the witness chair, sitting on the lip of the bench's footrail, was a stenographer capturing the examinations. Stenographers clicked away with pencil in hand throughout the trial and were changed regularly in relays. Surrounding the four major defense and prosecution counselors were an entourage of uniformed police, plainclothes detectives, undercover armed security men, government staff, and magistrates. The significance of Leo Frank's left fist would be revealed when evidence from the Mary Fagan autopsy conducted in early May of 1913 by Dr. H.F. Harris was reported during the Leo Frank trial. Mary Fagan had been punched in her right eye, causing her to fall backward and slamming the back of her head against the handle of a lathe in the metal room. The first day of the four-week-long Leo Frank trial began on July 28, 1913, and led to many days of successively more horrifying revelations. But the most interesting day of the trial occurred 3 weeks later, when Leo Frank sat down in the witness stand on Monday afternoon, August 18, 1913. Everyone in Georgia had a question they wanted to be answered. What Leo Frank had to say to the court became the spine-tingling climax of the most notorious criminal trial in U.S. history, and it was the moment everyone in all of Georgia, especially Atlanta, had waited for.